Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
I'm just thrilled, pleased, and privileged, you know, tickle me pink, to introduce Jamie Marich in our session today, Bleeding All Over Each Other, The Risk and Contamination of Unhealed Trauma. So Jamie describes herself as a facilitator of transformative experiences and is the founder of the Institute of Creative Mindfulness, a clinical trauma specialist, expressive artist, writer, yogini, performer, short filmmaker, Reiki master, and recovery advocate, and probably 10 other things that she's shy to mention. She unites all of these elements in her mission to inspire healing in others. Jamie travels internationally, teaching on topics related to trauma, EMDR therapy, expressive arts, mindfulness, and yoga, while maintaining a private practice in her home. So please, Jamie, take it away.
Thank you so much, Cheryl, for the beautiful introduction. Hello to everybody who's joining us from around the world. I always love on these webinars when I see people put where they're from. It just helps me to be filled with chills about how connected we all are. And that even though technology can come with its drawbacks, one of the benefits of it is that it can help those of us to connect who may not ordinarily connect. And I see several friends and colleagues are here on the presentation and several friends I haven't met yet. So welcome to all of you. I hope we can start with a little bit of centering and grounding. Since this is a heavy topic we are discussing today, I think it's very important to find our ground and to realize that if you should get activated, drift at any time, that can be normal when we're talking about trauma, especially if you are a very embodied person who listens with your body. And so having these grounding anchors can be just so imperative for our own safety as we listen in on this content. So the first thing I'd like to invite you to do is to take a nice organic stretch. Don't be afraid to make a sound with it. And when we take these organic stretches, I like to intone the spirit of a dog, a cat, or a baby. Because if you think about how dogs or cats or babies move, they're typically not afraid to do whatever feels good in the body. And so I'll give you about 20, 30 seconds for this process of organic stretching. If possible, really try to link your breath with it, make a sound. Just let the body fully arrive. So I'll invite you to take a look around the space that you're in and notice what you see. Notice colors, notice textures. Maybe notice what you hear in your space or outside the space, or maybe it's absent a sound for you. Perhaps take a breath and notice if there's a smell in your awareness. Perhaps swallow and notice if there's a taste or if you have a beverage nearby. Perhaps you take a sip of that beverage and make contact. And then there's a lot of different ways we can engage touch or sensation. It can be as simple as touching your clothes, touching your chair, maybe touching an object that you have nearby. Like I have a stress ball here, some protector figurines, a rock, a seed that one of my friends from India gave me. I keep this here as a grounding and a good memory. So of the five major senses we just scanned, perhaps notice which two seem to have the strongest resonance for you. For me, it's typically texture and visual. So whenever I go into any type of presentation like this, I like to keep a note of what my two big skills are and just know that I could come to them as an anchor at any time. And then one final grounding technique or just embodiment technique I'd like to give you here before I formally go into the presentation is a yoga mudra called Mudra of Supreme Confidence. And you can engage this by simply interlacing the fingers. And you can bring them to touch your heart, or if touching the body feels too activating, just bring them at an appropriate distance away from the body where you can still sense into the protection of this gesture. And perhaps take three breaths at the depth that feels appropriate for you today. And this is some heart-opening work that we'll be talking about today. And if you've been attending this whole conference, you've likely been invited to go into the heart and to the body. And this is also just a lovely protective container that I like to engage sometimes. If talks that I'm listening to are getting too heavy, sometimes when I watch movies or film that can be a little triggering, it's like, all right, I'm taking it in. I'm okay. I'm in my window. But this is just an extra guard here to protect my heart. So I'm joining you from Youngstown, Warren, Ohio area, which is about an hour south of Cleveland, for those of you who know US geography. I always like to say that the part of Ohio I'm from is the beginning of the middle. So if you're coming from New York and you're heading out west, Ohio would be where the middle starts. And that's where I'm at. So thank you, Cheryl, for the introduction and talking about my background from a professional perspective. I am a trauma therapist. I've been a trauma therapist for many, many years now. I began my career when I was working in Bosnia. My family is Croatian, so I went to that part of the world shortly after the Civil War. I was there from 2000 to 2003. And to make a very long story short, I went there as an English teacher and I came back as a social worker. And then ended up going into clinical counseling, specializing in trauma. I'm an EMDR trainer. I've written several books in the field of trauma recovery, EMDR therapy, trauma-informing 12-step work. So that's a little bit of who I am professionally. I'm also a yoga teacher, a mindfulness teacher. But the focus of this talk today, yes, I will be bringing in some of my professional expertise, but it is really my intention to get more personal with you today, because any study of trauma and social change invites us to go inward and really do that personal work. And I hope to model some of that today. So the title of this presentation, Bleeding All Over Each Other. I'm often curious, and this is where I regret that we don't have a little bit more interaction. What maybe came up for you when you saw this on the menu of sessions that you can choose from? For me, as I know many of you in this room have studied with, have read the great trauma leaders, the great scholarships that are out there on trauma, and so many of the great ones have their definitions of trauma that are a go-to. My definition I like to keep pretty simple, and it is very much inspired by my background as an English teacher. I am way more an English teacher than I am a social worker, or scientist, I should say, when it comes to this content. And anytime somebody asks me for my working definition of something in our field, I tend to always go to the word origin. So the English word trauma, some of you may know this, comes from the Greek word meaning wound. So when I am asked as an author, as a teacher, as a trauma therapist, My working definition of trauma, it is any unhealed wound. So just let that sit with you for a moment. Trauma, as even the gentleman who gave the ad at the beginning of this presentation gave a definition of trauma. So trauma is any unhealed wound. Life wounds us all. You cannot escape this experience of life without getting wounded in some way, physically, emotionally, spiritually, sexually, etc., financially. The wounds themselves are not the problem. One time I wrote a blog just for a little bit of shock value called Why Trauma is Not the Problem. And my intention was to get people thinking about the trauma itself, the wound itself is not necessarily the problem. Because if wounds get the proper treatment that they need, if wounds get the proper space that they need in order to air out and heal and integrate into the full system, the trauma may go on to be not much of an issue, or it may lead to this phenomenon that we sometimes now will refer to as post-traumatic growth. But by and large, if you're a clinician or if you're a healer or a body worker or working in any of the professions that are represented in this conference, when people come to us, it's because the wounds are unhealed. Perhaps because they're still bleeding. And then there's that natural connection that if a wound is bleeding, it may have the potential to contaminate others who come into contact with it. So let's break down a little bit of this wound metaphor, because I teach, and this is the thesis of my 2016 book, Trauma Made Simple, that understanding the wound metaphor and how to treat it really does sit at the heart of trauma work and knowing how to bring about some kind of meaningful healing. And so whenever students are coming to me to learn about how to work with trauma, I will say, let's first unpack this wound metaphor. So what I'd encourage all of you to do right now, and I will obviously engage some of my examples here that I like to share what I teach, but maybe take about 30 seconds just to yourself, and I'm going to try to turn off this notification because I know we've heard it a couple times. What is it that you know about physical wounds and how they heal? What is it you know about physical wounds and how they heal? And if you want, you can go ahead and type them in the chat. I have access to the chat, so I might be able to give us a little bit of an interaction that way. So what is it that you know about physical wounds and how they heal? Okay, good. I'm getting some participations here. Okay, yes, they heal from the inside out. Very often we need to stabilize them from the outside in, using things like compresses, stitches, washing it out, maybe even needing medical attention for that. So yes, stabilization may need to happen from the outside in, but deep healing has to happen from the inside out. And for those of you who know about triune brain work, it's the same idea that we may engage some stabilization from the outside in, but the deep healing really is from the inside out. Hello, Ginny, my fellow Ohioan, who's not too far from me. I saw you introduce yourself, also voting for healing for the inside out. Yet wounds can heal themselves with time. And I think that's important to recognize that time is a factor here, that wounds can take a very, very short time to cause, but a disproportionately longer time to heal. And I will often say that, yes, the body, and a lot of you know this logic, the body is designed to heal itself, for sure. The body has a lot of the resources that it needs to heal itself. But I will add to that if conditions are right. So if you're still living in a cesspool of germs and filth, the wound may have a good chance of contaminating. If you're living in an environment where the wound continues to be picked at and reopened, that even that natural process of healing over time that the body likes to engage can get affected. And yes, we've heard this logic that the body has everything it needs to heal itself, but often that comes at the expense of other systems being compromised. Okay, let's see some other participation here. Yes, they need treatment. All wounds need treatment. All physical wounds need treatment. I would ask you to consider, though, that all wounds may not need professional treatment. Treatment can be what we've talked about: time, space, air. Treatment can mean putting some ointment on a wound, putting a bandage on it, and then letting time do its thing. But some wounds may need professional care, especially if the location is vulnerable, if the cut was too deep. And this is the parallel I like to make to emotional wounding, that sometimes when you get an emotional wound, you just need to have it validated. You may need a friend to kind of talk it out with. You may need the time and space to engage in your own embodied practices, and you may not need to engage a professional. Yet other wounds may require that you engage professional assistance. We have a lot more votes here for they need time. They may heal on their own sometimes. The body has capacity. They scab over first. Yes, and a lot of that scabbing over is part of that innate protection that the body gives us, but it gives that outside in type of protection. Yeah, first swelling. Swelling is often a sign that things can actually be healing for sure. Keep it clean, easier to heal if edges are straight, cover up. Yep, it's a process. Cleaning and air, they need time to heal. They can leave a scar. And the thing about scars is that some scars hurt, some scars don't. Some scars will leave a mark, but not have many physical complications, and other scarring will lead to physical complications. And there are a lot of variables at play that can determine that. For instance, how deep was the cut? Was proper treatment given at the time? Was infection part? A lot of us globally now know that term immunocompromised, if you didn't before, that if a person already has some vulnerabilities and problems with immune system or other blood disorders, what may feel like a simple scrape for me can be a serious issue that needs medical attention and can lead to scarring complication. So another teaching point I like to make there is there's so many variables that we have to look at here, that yes, on the surface, it can look like two people get wounded in the same way, but there may be a lot of other issues that are playing in. So they hurt and sting, especially if you touch them. Yes. If a wound is giving an appropriate healing modality, it can heal. They can also be connected to our emotions. Yep. So thank you for those of you who participated. If you like to look at chat, you can also see what some other folks may be adding as well. A couple other things I want to mention, because I can talk about this metaphor all day. It's so at the heart of how I teach on trauma. And I hope you're already seeing that some of these physical wound descriptions apply to what we know about emotional wounding, spiritual wounding, and the other types of wounding that we tend to work with in the people that we serve. So a comment that's often made here is, well, might emotional wounds be worse sometimes because they're not seen? Yeah, that can definitely be the case. I know a lot of people who are traumatized or who have a injury or an illness that's not so visible will say, if I had a broken leg, I feel like people would show me a little bit more grace than having what feels like this unseen injury. People will look at me and say, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, but the wounding is all inside. So a couple more points I want to make on this metaphor, which will lead to the title of this talk. Some wounds may never truly heal. I know that sounds like a bit of a scandalous thing to say, so I will explain myself in that comment. Some wounds may never truly heal. A lot of that depends on how you're defining healing. Because if you're defining healing as this process of going back to normal or going back to the way things should be, that may never happen with some physical injuries. And when I teach that point, I often bring up the example of my friend Heather, who was born with one leg. Now, she was born with one leg because of her father's Agent Orange exposure in Vietnam. So Heather will never get her leg back. Wound care, injury care for Heather will never mean that her leg grows back and she's restored to the way that things should have been. But what Heather has been able to do is adapt. And she's been able to adapt, and that's a word we use a lot in trauma-focused care. She's been able to adapt because of resources. So prosthetic technology, having a good support system, having a spiritual frame of reference, artistic coping. She does a lot of advocacy work with children of other Vietnam vets. And so in the presence of these resources, Heather has been able to adapt and thrive and live a very healthy and happy life. Now consider though, that a lot of our clients don't have those resources or aren't shown how to use them. And so I do believe that a lot of trauma healing is about accessing resources and learning how to use them. And too often we take it for granted that people just know how to do that. I mean, the most horrible saying or idiom in the English language is pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And people who don't get trauma or people who maybe have a different agenda and how they approach life will often say that, well, overcome, I did it. Yeah, and somebody said here on the chat, what if you don't have boots? Sure, what if you don't have boots? What if you don't have straps? Or maybe you have both and nobody ever told you, taught you how to do it. So the key here really is the cultivation of resources and teaching people how to use them. And a little mini soapbox I'll get on here, although this whole talk is a bit of a soapbox, is that yes, I'm all about these amazing trauma modalities, like EMDR therapy, somatic experiencing, trauma-informed yoga. I do so many of them, but I often feel that some of the basic trauma work we have to do with folks is starting with the social work 101, accessing food, water, and shelter, accessing resources in the community that a person may need in order to get their basic needs met, for them to even be open to doing more of this deeper work. So accessing resources and teaching people how to use them is an important part of that. And yes, I mean, clients have asked me all the time, well, what if I don't get over it? What if I can't get over it? What does healing even mean? And healing means different things to different people. We see that in physical injury, in the case of chronic illness or a chronic injury, like I just described with Heather. And it can happen on the emotional side too. And many other people will believe that they are fully restored, that they are living in this state where they're better than they were even before. So I think it's very humane for us to let people define healing how they will. All right, so here's where this whole idea of bleeding all over each other comes in. So I'd like you to imagine, I'll use the most global possible example of sport here and say football or soccer, because I know it's football most anywhere else in the world, but here in the US we call it soccer. So whether you're saying football or soccer, imagine that a football player gets their knee cut, maybe cut open and they're bleeding during a game. What could happen, and you could just answer to yourself, or if you want to participate with chat, you may. What could happen if they go back into the game and do nothing? What could happen if they go back into the game and do nothing? So let's say the football player is bleeding from their knee. Got a couple examples here. They might die. Yeah, it's definitely a worst case scenario, but it can certainly happen, especially if they get re-injured, reinfected. Maybe another player tries to take advantage of the fact that they're injured. They could bleed. They can contaminate others. That's the big thing here about bleeding all over each other. Yep, they can definitely contaminate others, infect others, because let's face it, open blood sores are generally not considered safe. We've been able to kind of get with that program in the physical health side of things, but I have a concern that we've not really gotten with that program on the mental emotional sides of things in healthcare. The wound can get bigger, they could injure themselves more, bleed all over, contour bleeding, permanent injury, yes, yes, yes. These are all good, but there's one you didn't hit on yet. And that is the soccer player, the football player could go back into the game and nothing can happen. Nothing could happen. They may go back into the game and even score the winning goal if they're brought on by adrenaline, right? And in sporting culture, that's often expected to happen. And I'm not here to specifically comment on sporting culture other than to say what we do in general society often parallels that. That if you're hurt, don't be a pansy or some other expletive and get back in the game. Play. And we tend to appreciate and laud those people who can play well hurt. but then we criticize those people who may not need or who may need to ask for help or who can't rise to the occasion. A lot of us may remember, if you follow gymnastics, this was certainly a pivotal sporting moment of my young adulthood when Carrie Strug, the gymnast during the 1996 Olympics, landed a vault on a broken ankle, on one foot essentially, to protect the broken ankle. And that was lauded as this heroic act. And even now with some of the advocacy around safe sport, that's been looked at as, was that really child abuse, expecting her to go in at 17 and land this vault on the broken ankle? And think about that. We do that as society. We applaud people who can perform while hurt. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily a bad thing if you can muster the adrenaline, muster your resources and power through. But if you do that, are you able to care for yourself afterwards? And can we show more grace and compassion to people who may say, no, I need the time out? So I want us to consider that some people play hurt, they power through it, push through it, and may not realize until years and years later how hurt they really are underneath, or going to the title of this talk, how much they've contaminated each other, how much they've bled all over each other by playing hurt. Tim, I just caught your comment here. 95% of all humans are walking around playing hurt in life. Yeah, I mean, I don't have an exact number, but I would say it's definitely high. It is most definitely high. And yes, that can be causing damage to ourselves, most certainly. But part of this idea of bleeding all over each other is, are we contaminating others and not even realizing it? And thinking about what is happening in the world. It's a mess right now. It's not to say that what's happening now is anything new. But I think there's something about 2020 with the pandemic and with other forces in the world that are at play, with rising attention, justifiably so, given to racism and gender discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination, there's been this collective call to pay more attention. And how much of what we are experiencing in the world right now is this phenomenon of people have been bleeding all over each other since the dawn of time. And we keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And here we are, just all a bunch of wounded people. Some people have embraced the call of healing more fully than others. And I think a lot of us are the ones who are trying to make a difference here and be the change. But even part of doing this healing work requires us to always be looking at how might I still be bleeding all over each other because of things of mine that I haven't quite addressed. And thank you, Cameron, for the hug. I very much appreciate it. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I was in a really bad way. I myself am the survivor of complex trauma, sexual abuse and spiritual abuse primarily. I first began self-injuring and made a half-hearted yet still valid attempt at taking my life when I was 9 years old. By the time I finished high school and went to college, I had a full-blown addiction issue. So trauma is something that is very, very personal to my story. And if I had not been met in life by a mentor who understood trauma in my early 20s, I would not be here today as a woman in her early 40s speaking with you. So at the beginning of the pandemic, as I already said, life was hitting on me pretty hard. And there were two factors that were really at play with that. One was I was busy. I mean, a lot of you are busy, so I don't certainly mean to imply that I was any busier than any of the rest of you. But prior to the pandemic, I always laugh now when people read my bio saying Jamie travels internationally speaking on topics connected to X, Y, and Z. before the pandemic, I definitely traveled internationally. I haven't been on a plane since March. But in my pre-pandemic life, I was on a plane at least two or three times a month, going different places, teaching, doing work connected to my company. And it was a life that several years back I embraced as part of what my dharma was in this world to make the difference and share teachings. And I'm a traveler and I liked it, but I always had to be conscious about, Jamie, are you still taking care of yourself? Are you drinking enough water? Are you engaging in your practices? Because the road mixed with a little bit of workaholism can certainly be a very unforgiving place. So one of my self-care practices that I routinely did in my pre-pandemic life was to take the month of December off, where I would just not get on a plane. I would keep a workload very light here at the beginning of December and just really let myself have that month of hibernation to settle. So in December of last year, it was December 10th specifically, one of my oldest, dearest, best friends died by suicide. His name was Jason. He and I became friends when we were in university, in college. I was 18, he was 19 when he met. The story is I was the last girl he had a crush on before he came out. And after that, we just became fast friends and would share music together and stories and tales of growing up in a repressed conservative Christian household and what it was like being queer. I'm also a bisexual woman, and I was nowhere close to ready to come out when I was 19 or so and 18 and had met Jason, but he was coming out. So we stayed friends all that time. We had lost touch for several years at one point. And then we re-engaged contact when Jason began to enter a recovery path again. He had struggled for many, many, many years, and he had gone through treatment again and reached out to me. And he actually found my book, Trauma and the 12 Steps, the first edition, when he was in treatment. And he ended up finding me on Facebook and getting my number and calling me saying, Jamie, I didn't realize you were like not just sober, but actually like doing things in the treatment world and the trauma world. And he said, do you think we could hang out sometime? And we did. And for the last 5 years of his life, we were very, very, very close. Jason had access to so many of these resources that I talked about, EMDR, more conventional therapy, 12-step recovery. He developed a yoga practice. He actually trained in dancing mindfulness, the program that I do, about a year and a half before he passed. And he always struggled with being able to stay sober and well for about 6 months, and then something would happen and he would fall off, and often we wouldn't hear from him, or just very, very destructive things would happen. And in the few months before he died, he was incarcerated, and he got out of jail and was committed in a way I hadn't seen him be committed before. And I went to visit him before he got out. And we talked a little bit. He put his plan into place. He was set up with his EMDR, with his yoga practice again. And we had several very deep conversations in those last months. And he revealed to me during one of them about the level of shame he still carried that just would not go away about him being gay. And we talked a lot about the scars that church left on us, especially him. And I want to be very clear, I am not anti-religion, I am not anti-faith, but I take serious issues with religions and faith that believe bullying LGBT folks is a part of what you need to worship, because that's the kind of container we were both raised in. And if I'm being honest, there's still days I feel like there's remnants of that I have to shake. And a lot of the current climate can bring that up for me, right? And one of our last conversations, Jason said, I don't know if I'll ever get over it. And he relapsed again and had just a lot of shame about the fact that he relapsed, feeling this was his last time. And then in December, he took his own life. So my month that I usually spend in self-care and hibernation, I was doing a lot of coordinating, because I maintained a closeness to Jason's family, and I was very involved in planning activities, and I was glad to be. I don't mean any of this to sound like I'm coming down on him, because his path is his path. And when I found out that he took his life, I honestly will say I was filled with about 100,000 feelings all at once, from letting out expletives to just deep grief and pain to feeling actually deep relief. I think I said relief, that this was the choice he made. And maybe this was the way in this life he was going to get some peace to go on to the next. You know, I don't know. I don't know what was going through his process. I mean, I have some ideas based on, you know, what he left behind, but and then it just ushered in a period of really big grief, and I'm still grieving it. I mean, I don't think you ever really stop grieving, especially somebody who you're that close to, right? But December really kind of brought that all on, and then the holidays, and then first week of January, I was back on the road again. And I felt this sense of just, I don't know how much longer I could do this. I don't know much how longer I could travel. Why the heck am I teaching about trauma? Is this doing any good in the world anyway? And it was mounting and mounting and mounting and mounting. And then I heard about this coronavirus thing that was happening. And I'm not proud to admit this, but I'll admit that this was going through my head. I said, if I catch this coronavirus, then maybe I'll actually be allowed to take a couple weeks off. And think about that. That we can still have this stigma, right, about taking time off, taking space off to take care of ourselves for mental health. And I'm a person who has routinely been able to schedule time off for myself. But because I had so many things booked, so many commitments in place, I knew that taking the time off for myself that I needed would mean letting down a lot of people and letting go of a lot of commitments. And I will be quite honest that the very week before the big social distancing requirements started, I was traveling out to California, and I had some glimmers of my own battles of suicidal ideation come back. It was in a morning before I was getting ready to get on a plane. And it was just like, why am I doing this? Maybe Jason had an idea, right? Fortunately, I was okay, because I know what to do. I know how to use those resources. I called upon my therapist and my friends, and they just gave me a lot of space and permission to cry, to wail, to be what I needed to be. And I was able to get through the last bits of work I had to get through and didn't destroy myself in the process. But that was so resonant for me that that went through my head, right? Well, if I get this coronavirus, I'll be allowed to take a few weeks off. And that, to me, is one of the great travesties of what, to me anyway, COVID-19 has highlighted, that we take such precautions. And I'm not saying it's this way all over the world, and certain places can definitely struggle and suffer with healthcare inequities, for sure. But we tend to go on high alert when it comes to physical risk and contamination. And I honestly, and I'm a student of history, but this is the first time I ever really heard the phrase social distancing. And yeah, I know what it's like to have poor immunity, but I never heard the term immunocompromised. And now it's such a part of my vernacular. Because what this pandemic has arisen is, well, here's what we can do to take care of each other to prevent the spread. And we have certainly seen cracks in the system, for sure. But when I saw us go in to these intense periods of protecting each other to flatten this curve physically, another thought I had was, why aren't we doing this with trauma? Why aren't we doing this with addiction? Because we know how unhealed trauma spreads. It's this phenomenon of bleeding all over each other, or coughing, spraying, if we're using more of that splash idea that COVID has brought into our vernacular. And in this area of trauma and mental health and addiction, just think of how many people don't care. what they're spreading, how they're spreading. And so many of us end up getting infected and we cross-contaminate. And as a result, I feel and firmly assert that unhealed trauma has been the greatest pandemic of humankind's existence on this earth. Another reading that I engaged in during the earlier days of the pandemic was Rezma Menakem's My Grandmother's Hands. If you haven't read it, I strongly emphasize it, especially if you have interest in looking at what is racial trauma, racial discord, racial disharmony all about. And he uses this phrase quite a bit in that book: we blow our unclean pain through each other. We blow our unclean pain through each other and we pass it on intergenerationally. And when I heard those words, because I listened to it in a book on tape, it was like, yep, that's this whole idea of bleeding all over each other, coughing all over each other, sneezing all over each other, using whatever bodily process you want. And I was also reminded of the work of another great influence on me, Stephanie Covington, who was the author of A Woman's Way Through the 12 Steps, and truly was one of the leaders in bringing gender competency into addiction treatment. And I heard Stephanie keynote many years ago, and she said, in the physical healthcare system, we have gotten better about this idea of not passing along bloodborne pathogens, airborne pathogens, and we take universal best precautions in physical settings. And though some parts of the world have been more stubborn with this than others, COVID has really taught us the importance of doing that to prevent the spread with the physical urgency of this pandemic. But what is keeping us from embracing a lot of that same logic with looking at trauma, with looking at our mental health, with looking at addiction? And I think a lot of it goes back to a point I made earlier when I unpacked the wound metaphor, right? Which is, we tend to take more seriously that which we can physically see. If I have a broken leg, you may be more likely to show me compassion than if I'm walking around with an illness that you cannot see. So I do think that's part of it. And another part of it, I think, is that doing trauma work is hard. It's hard to look at our stuff. And the best treatment that I have encountered is giving yourself permission to feel your feelings, to go there, to get real with those emotions, to experience that which you've been holding in. And that is the treatment, yet so many of us have been taught, have been socialized, have been just pounded in our heads to fear that. To fear feeling, to fear going there, or to think that we're not safe or that it's not appropriate, that we're just so damn scared of feeling. Yet that is the thing, if done appropriately, if done in a safe context, in a supportive context, that can liberate us. I'll wrap up with a few points here, and then I'd like to hear some of your questions. I've had a lot of suicide in my life. I know I told you about Jason's story. I know I told you about some of my own history with ideation and attempts. I had a friend die by suicide when I was 12. And I had an aunt by marriage die by suicide about 7 years ago. And when it happened, you know, in this very conservative family of mine, my brother actually approached me to get some support, and he's like, well, I want to carry some of the support that you're offering to the family, because you know that a lot of our conservative types just don't do well with feeling. And I said at that point, isn't that interesting? And I would just encourage all of you to think, you know, why is that? Maybe if points in your life you have struggled with feeling, what's that been about for you? And how can you use some of what you've learned to be able to spread healing to others instead of continuing this phenomenon of bleeding all over and contaminating each other? All right, so a few resources I want to put in the chat for you. The original article that I wrote at the beginning of the pandemic, What I Wish People Understood About Risk and Contamination. I published that on my company's blog, Institute for Creative Mindfulness. So if you want to read a little bit more about the rawness of that share, you're certainly free to do that. The link is in the chat. And I also want to let you know about a free resource page that I keep on the interwebs called traumamadesimple.com. It is based on the title of my 2014 book, Trauma Made Simple. And I keep this resources site. It's basically everything. Yes, Cameron, I've posted the links. Just scroll up a little bit. We have traumamadesimple.com. That one's pretty simple to remember. And then I have the blog link to the risk and contamination piece that I wrote at the beginning of the pandemic. Yeah, the resources site features everything for free that I've done online. I know some people are saying they can't see the links. I don't know if I have permission to screen share. It looks like I do. So traumamadesimple.com. I am pasting them. I know some of you are saying you can't see them. So if you just remember traumamadesimple.com. And the risk and contamination article, I actually posted it in the embodiment group on Facebook yesterday. So if it is listed there. And then I will share the risk and contamination link one more time for that blog. Although you can actually find the risk and contamination article on Trauma Made Simple. Because one other thing I want to share with you is on Trauma Made Simple. If you go under articles and interviews, like I said, everything I've written, everything I've done for free is here. So what I wish people understood about risk and contamination, I keep a pretty active YouTube channel with all kinds of demonstrations, EMDR demonstrations, mindful breathing, mindful yoga that's delivered from a trauma-informed lens, some of my dancing mindfulness work you can access on YouTube. And then there's also dancingmindfulness.com. which if you're interested in more of my expressive arts work, you can look at as well. I know there are questions, so I'm findable on the internet. So you can find me. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Jamie. And I just feel like, you know, the need to take a breath because, you know, so rich and so poignant. But yeah, into questions, because yes, there's probably more than we can get to. Right. So by order of voting, if we need to be together to heal rather than self-isolate, how do we prevent ourselves from hurting others while still healing?
That's an excellent question. I think accountability can be an important part of that process. So having people in your healing network and in recovery work, we talk a lot about having a sponsor or a mentor. That can be useful. For instance, I checked in this morning with my friend about something that I maybe didn't say that was too nice to somebody yesterday. So I think creating those spaces where we can not feel ashamed to share where we may have messed up, I think can be an important part of that. And I also believe another skill called containment is vital. We teach it a lot in EMDR and in a lot of other forms of trauma-informed work. It can be visualizing a container for your emotions as if to say, okay, just hold them for me for a while, because right now is not the venue for me to be spouting them all over the place. And in expressive arts work, we often have people make containers as a visual symbol for themselves to just kind of hold what's heavy. And I know I've gotten very used to this process of working with my container. So there's so much more I can say, but those are my two general points. And thank you for the question.
Great. Next, can trauma ever actually be healed, or do we just learn different ways to manage and hide it more effectively?
I think that depends on how you're defining healing. It goes back to the point I made earlier in the physical metaphor that some wounds may never heal, if we're defining healing as going back to the way things should be. And there's different definitions of healing that abound. I know Van der Kolk's often resonates for me, which is kind of being able to move through life knowing that the danger has passed. That might be one definition of it. But I think healing is subjective, just like the experience of trauma is subjective. But I do think if you are just going through life, coping and covering and coping and covering, if that's working for you, I don't begrudge that. But I would challenge you to ask yourself, is that really healing or is it just coping? Because I do know that healing and transformation is possible. And even if stuff comes up like, hey, I'm 18 years sober. I experienced a little flare of some suicidal ideation after a friend of mine died by suicide, right? The point is the fact that I knew how to manage it. I knew how to go to my resources. I knew how to just let myself feel what I needed to feel. That meant I was still in the healing process. And for me, healing is a process. I don't ever want to say that I'm 100% cured because there's always something that I can learn from the healing. Thank you for the question.
And another, how do we heal when systemic oppression continues to affect us on a daily basis?
Well, it's a big question. It's a good question. And I can only speak from my experience as a bisexual woman, knowing that I still have a great deal of privilege because I'm white, because I'm educated, because I have a lot of financial resources. So I don't pretend to speak for everybody when I answer this question. Find your pockets of safety. Find your pockets of safety. Find the people, places, and things in your life where you can get that breather and that refuge where you don't have to be in fight mode. And then once you have found your pockets of safety, who give you enough of what you need resource-wise and space-wise to be able to do some of the healing work, I very much recommend getting involved in some way. Advocacy can lead to burnout. I do want to make that point. Even Resma talks about that in My Grandmother's Hands. So even if you do get involved as an advocate, it's not going to be a cover-up if you don't do the deep healing work as well. But I know for me, doing some advocacy around this current election in the US is very, very much helping. Using my platform online to elevate voices that need elevated has been a big part of what has helped me. Speaking out when I see abuses towards the gay community, giving money that I have to give towards causes like Project Trevor has been very important to me. So getting involved. And case in point, on election day here in the US, which I know is going to be one big trauma trigger day for me, I signed up to work the polls because I'm a physically healthy person who wants to be there to hold space for people who need to vote. And so getting involved, getting into action, it's been a game changer for me. And I hope that's something I can continue to do, but in concert with continuing healing practices, self-care, and my own therapy.
Great. And I think probably our last one, how do you stop being scared of feeling when you've never been allowed to feel certain things like anger, never learned to self-soothe, and so are always at risk of flooding?
It's a practice. And I think if that is your concern, if you have the ability, the privilege to work with somebody like a good trauma-focused therapist, a trauma-focused body worker, yoga teacher, help them give you skills for being able to do it in bite-sized pieces. Because for so many of us, that's the way that we have to do it. I think the process of titration or feeling a little bit, coming back to safety can be very important. But I will say that just avoiding it is not going to be helpful for you or anyone else around you. But at the same time, I want to show compassion that I know that that can feel like the safe base. But I quote here the teaching of Tom Zimmerman, who actually was my student, but now he's become my teacher in a lot of ways, and he works on my EMDR training faculty. He'll say, yes, there's a risk in doing trauma work. There's a risk in feeling your feelings, but there's a bigger risk in not doing trauma work, in not feeling your feelings, especially if it's going to keep you stuck in the rut of however those symptoms are playing out in your life. Thank you for the question.
Thank you so much. It's such a powerful session, right from the heart of your own experience. So appreciate it so much. Just to post, you know, if you want to continue the conversation, consider joining the Facebook groups or the coffee break in the portal. I've had a chance to join some of them, and great conversations. I just want to highlight, our next presenter on this channel is Leonora Barauci, looking at embodiment through healing trauma at the causal layer. So that's happening in about 3 hours from now. Again, just a quick nod to our channel sponsor, Steve Hoskinson, and I'll just post, what he's made available. And I would just sort of say, it's deeply important, I think, to Mark and the whole team that as many people as able to can access the conference. And I've been overwhelmed with the generosity of presenters, like Jamie and others, with how much free material they're sharing through this. But if you want to own the library, either for this channel or for the whole conference to digest it in your own time, you know, we really appreciate it, because that's actually what enables us to make it access, free for live. And just as a thank you, because there are, at this point, over 100 people working behind the scenes to make this possible at all levels of, free and barely paid levels. I'm the least of that. So, it's a kind of thank you for us for the work from the heart to make it happen. And so I'll just put that link here, but I'll bring it back to you, Jamie, for a top tip about how to be more embodied.
Yes, thank you for that. And I just want to let everybody know, I'm planning on hanging out in the coffee lounge for a little bit after this, if people want to interact with me there. I think that's a wonderful resource. So my top tip for being more embodied is to remember the power of this organic stretch that we started the session with. It can be as simple as just moving your pinkies or your fingers, especially if your mobility isn't where you would like it to be or where it's possible to be at any given point. But wherever you can be, even if you think of accessing your breath and how the breath may move more organically, this is one of my greatest secrets throughout the day, right? Is just being able to pop into this organic stretch at any time, especially if I'm feeling some stress, some tension. If I've watched too much news, it's organic stretch, and then shake it off a little bit, dance it off a little bit. If you take nothing else from me in terms of tools, that would be it.
Great. Thank you so much, Jamie. I really appreciate it. And thanks everyone for joining us today.
Thank you.
Great. Take care. Have a good one.